Greetings and gestational miasma, my redactic listeners, and welcome to this November 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this naively optimistic podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Okay, we are actually back with actual idiot scientists this month. Yeah, I know, this is what you guys have been waiting for. More complete morons. Note that I am not talking about a single idiot here. Apparently, from an article I just read in the journal The Scientist, the country of Ukraine seems to have a large population of idiot scientists who have no problem with plagiarism, making up pseudoscience, bribes, and cheating. Wow. The article came out at the end of October and was written by Emil Filtenborg and Stefan Weikert. Dr. Viktor Dosenko, the head of the physiology department at the Ukrainian National Academy of Sciences, says, quote, "In our country, cheating by scientists is not seen as a problem," unquote. According to Dosenko, around 90% of all science professors in the Ukraine are not legitimate researchers. This is partly due to the high level of plagiarism, people paying others to do their work, and some students bribing teachers to let them graduate, he says. There you go. Can you even call them scientists at this point? You have to wonder if they are just full of BS. It's such a mess in the Ukraine that the Ministry of Education and Science is introducing a new system that will create more control over universities' ethics and potentially remove their right to award degrees to apparently anybody who's breathing. If that nonsense is not enough, some Ukrainian scientists graduate from questionable universities and do not submit their research for peer review. Dosenko points out that he has difficulties finding many scientists in his own medical field on PubMed. He says, quote, "Try to search for any professors or any dean or any directors of a medical university in the Ukraine. You will not find anything. Why? Because they are not bothering to actually let other legitimate scientists critique their work," unquote. Dosenko admits his assessment of misconduct or subpar work in Ukrainian science is just an estimate, and hard data are hard to come by on just what the extent of the problems are. Yeah, of course. When you have BS artists doing the research, how can you trust the results of any studies or surveys done in the Ukraine? However, Dr. Elena Denisova-Schmid, a Swiss researcher at the University of St. Gallen, found in one study of undergraduate students in the Ukrainian city of Lviv that 93% of students reported that they had plagiarized schoolwork and that 48% said that they had paid bribes at their university to get passing grades. In an effort to clamp down on rampant plagiarism, Unicheck, a company that develops plagiarism detection software, recently offered its software pro bono to Ukrainian universities because it is such a desperate academic situation there. The sad part is, according to the scientist's story, that most universities in the Ukraine either did not respond or had no interest in the software. I'm not even sure how to comment on that, except that it just seems so unbelievable. If that seems bad, listen to this. Denisova-Schmidt says that students' practices in the university are indicative of academia as a whole in the Ukraine, including scientific research. And academia in Ukraine is subject to the same corruption that runs rampant throughout the country, she adds. In the article, Dr. Irina Yorhochenko, a senior researcher at the Institute of Mathematics, says, quote, "The problem is that Ukrainian academics either do not understand what science is, or they simply don't care. It creates a culture where a scientist is ready to take bribes to make ends meet on a low salary," unquote. Yorhochenko uses the case of Dr. Katerina Kirilenko, a professor of philosophy at Kiev National University, as an example of Ukrainian academic problems. In 2016, the Ukrainian pro-science group False Science found plagiarism in around one-third of Kirilenko's dissertation. But despite this, in an investigation by the Ukrainian Ministry of Education and Science, the ministry refused to withdraw her doctoral degree. Kirilenko has denied all accusations and says that all the accusations are politically motivated. Yorhochenko gave another example, like Kirilenko's, in which she was involved in a court case against Yuri Teslia, the former dean of information technology at Taras Shevchenko National University of Kiev who now works as vice rector at the National Aviation University in Kiev. And happily, we don't have a vice rector or a rector at my university, and I really hope we never get one. Anyway, Teslia sued Yurhachenko because she called his work pseudoscience. He does not see gravity as a force of attraction between objects, Yurhachenko says. And he concludes that objects inform each other about their existence, making their behavior change. That sounds like something Carlos Castaneda would say. If that isn't pseudoscience, then what the heck is that? However, Teslia has defended his integrity as a scientist, but the Kiev Court of Appeals declined his claim against Yurhachenko. In the article, Teslia defends his dementia by saying, quote, "I do not deny the works of Einstein or Newton, but instead I base my work on trying to build a world similar to ours in computer science, on their findings. Objects in my model inform each other due to gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear interactions. But this was known before me. What is new in theory is that objects change their movement by receiving information through the named fields." Unquote. I won't even pretend to understand. I know what that means. The man is either a freaking genius who is suggesting quantum entanglement occurs at macroscopic levels, where gravity is a reflection of quantum events, or he's a complete nutter. What do you think my vote is for? Dr. Pavlo Kutuev, the chair of sociology department at Igor Sikorsky Kiev Polytechnic Institute, says, "The problems in Ukrainian academia are influenced by underfunding and lots of bureaucracy. And furthermore, the Soviet Union made it difficult to conduct independent studies in humanities because of ideological control. He has participated in committees to both award degrees and develop guidelines to prevent issues in Ukrainian academia. The communists truly did screw up themselves and their satellites well." Kutuev says, quote, "I have personally observed a culture in which some committee members argue that a person should receive a degree because he or she is quote-unquote a nice fellow, or because that person, quote-unquote, supports the university or is well-connected." Yes, and believe it or not, I have been on committees with people like that. Let's not go there. Denisova Schmidt finishes with, quote, "This is not only a Ukrainian problem, but an issue for all the post-Soviet countries. Low pay and a culture where higher education is necessary to get even most jobs are part of the problem. For example, the challenges are substantial in medical science because doctors are expected to have a PhD, but rarely have time to do one." Unquote. Really? We don't even expect that here. MD PhDs are rare for a reason in the West. It takes hard work and massive talent to get both. It's hard enough to get into medical school. You have to be in the top 5% of the medical students to be enrolled in a PhD program also. You have to be nuts to want all MDs to have PhDs. My students have often asked me why I am so cautious of scientific research that gets published out of the former Soviet bloc countries. Now you know the answer. I cannot get excited about a breakthrough found in Kiev until I know it has been replicated by a laboratory somewhere, well, preferably west of Kiev. Next story. Okay, so you think, we are so darn superior to the Ukraine. Well, here's a bonus idiot scientist story from the United States. As with most active scientific researchers here in the quote-unquote developed world, part of my job is to be a peer reviewer for other scientists. This is volunteer work, and it's unpaid. We all read and review papers when journals ask us to do that. This is part of the price we pay to be academics. I take the job seriously, and I have probably been an ad hoc reviewer for 25 different research journals by this point. In addition, I am presently an assistant volunteer editor for a major plant biology journal. Again, I take these responsibilities seriously. Well, there are those in science who do not take it quite so seriously. Dr. Rebecca Lijek of Mount Holyoke College just published a study in eLife in October that reveals that lots of scientists shirk their responsibilities when it comes to being a peer reviewer. Many graduate students and postdocs write or help compose peer reviews their advisors are invited to provide, according to a survey of nearly 500 early career researchers. And often they do that without disclosing the fact to the journal, a practice that the survey authors consider to be ghostwriting. Lijek says, quote, "I think ghostwriting of peer reviews is one of the worst-kept secrets in academia. Everybody in the biomedical sciences knows about it," unquote. The paper says that 80% of surveyed scientists say that ghostwriting is unethical in various ways. Lijek believes it is an open secret that ghostwriting occurs for reviews at top labs. Quote, "When I was a postdoc at Harvard Med School, ghostwriting of reviews was just anecdotally common knowledge. Everybody did it. Everybody felt a little icky about it, but it was just part of our training. At least that's how the PIs looked at it," unquote. PI, remember, is primary investigator. That's the person in charge of a lab. I am a PI. Let me make 3 points clear. A, I have never been asked to ghostwrite a peer review. B, I have never written a ghostwritten review. And C, I have never had anyone ever write a peer review for me. Lijek attended a Howard Hughes Medical Institute conference back in 2018 that got her interested in ghostwriting. She found lots of younger colleagues who told her that, yeah, it's common, it happens all the time. I'm familiar with it. I'm very personally familiar with this, and this is just how it's done. And then there were older colleagues high up in editorial boards or journals, really senior PIs, who said, oh, that never happens? That's breaking the foundations of peer review. I fall into the second category. I feel naive, but I did not even know this was an issue. And probably this is in part because I came out of a background that is not biomedical. I have a feeling that it's much worse in the biomedical area than it is in some of the other sciences. Lijek was so concerned that she looked over 2,000 papers and found zero that talked about ghostwriting in peer reviews. No one admitted it was a thing in the literature at all. And she decided she had to follow up on this. So she did eventually publish the survey to try to illuminate the process and to see whose perceptions were right, the younger folks or the older folks' perception. Lijek has decided that the best way to actually change this unethical system is to actually go with the flow. If you can't beat them, join them. If PIs are going to do this anyway, then journals should change their policies and adopt policies that encourage what Lijek calls co-review. She says it will allow for training of postdocs and grad students in peer review, which is going to increase the pool of qualified reviewers. And having policies that address co-review and clearly draw a line where and when they allow co-review is going to make reviewers more free to say yes to reviewing. Lijek finishes with, quote, "If they know they can ethically get some help with the review process, we're really, really hoping that by shedding some light on this issue, it can catalyze change at journals," unquote. And frankly, as an editor, I think this would be awesome. One of my jobs is to ask researchers to review research articles that I'm assigned to by the journal. 75% of the time, PIs tell me to go blow because they are too busy to read a paper and write a peer review. If they could co-write the review officially with a qualified lab member, that would be awesome and more likely to get them to agree to reviewing a paper. And it would make my life so much easier. Okay, onward and upward. Voyager has finally passed into interstellar space. Wahoo! Last month, Dr. Don Gurnett and his staff at the University of Iowa reported in Nature Astronomy that the spacecraft Voyager 2 has entered the interstellar medium, the region of space between the bubble-shaped boundary produced by winds streaming outward from the sun. Voyager 2 thus becomes the second human-made object to journey out of our sun's influence. You probably don't remember, but back in 2012, I reported on this podcast that Voyager 1 had exited the solar system. In the new study, Gurnett confirmed Voyager 2's passage on November 5, 2019, into the interstellar medium by noting a definitive jump in plasma density detected by an Iowa-led plasma wave instrument on the spacecraft. The marked increase in plasma density is evidence of Voyager 2 journeying from the hot, lower-density plasma characteristic of the solar wind to the cool, higher-density plasma of interstellar space. It's also similar to the plasma density jump experienced by Voyager 1 that was reported, and you may remember when it crossed into interstellar space. Gurnett says, quote, "In a historical sense, the old idea that the solar wind will just gradually whittle away as you go further into interstellar space is simply not true. We show with Voyager 2 and previously with Voyager 1 that there's a distinct boundary out there. It's just astonishing how fluids, including plasmas, form boundaries," unquote. Gurnett, a professor emeritus in the University of Iowa Department of Physics and Astronomy, has been the principal investigator on the plasma wave instrument aboard Voyager 2 since it was launched in August of 1977. Yes, folks, since the OG Star Wars movie came out, Dr. Gurnett has been working on this project. And if that is not impressive enough, he is also the principal investigator on the plasma wave instrument aboard Voyager 1, 16 days after Voyager 2 was launched. Voyager 2's entry into interstellar space occurred at 119.7 astronomical units. That's more than 11 billion miles from the sun. Voyager 1 passed into interstellar space at 122.6 astronomical units. So there's some consistency there. The apparent reason that Voyager 2 is so far behind Voyager 1 by 7 years is that it had different missions and trajectories through space. Even with that 7-year difference, they crossed into the space outside our solar system at basically the same distances from the sun. That gives valuable clues to the structure of the heliosphere. The bubble, shaped sort of like a windsock, created by the sun's wind as it extends to the boundaries of the solar system. Gurnett says, quote, "It implies that the heliosphere is symmetric, at least at the 2 points where the Voyager spacecrafts cross. That says that these 2 points on the surface are almost at the same distance. That's almost a spherical front to this, like a blunt bullet," unquote. Data from the Iowa instrument on Voyager 2 also gives additional clues to the thickness of the heliosheath. That's the outer region of the heliosphere, and the point where the solar wind piles up against the approaching wind in interstellar space. Gurnett compares that to the effect of a snowplow pushing snow on a city street. The last measurement obtained from Voyager 1 was when the spacecraft was 146 astronomical units, or more than 13 billion miles from the sun. The plasma wave instrument is now recording that the plasma density is rising in data feeds from a spacecraft that is now so far away it takes 19 hours for that information to travel from Voyager 1 to Earth. Gurnett finishes with, quote, "The two Voyagers will outlast Earth. They're in their own orbits around the galaxy for 5 billion years or longer, and the probability of them running into anything in open space is almost zero, although they might look a little worn at the end of 5 billion years," unquote. Oh, I don't know. Once those advanced aliens do the refurbishing and detailing job predicted in the first Star Trek movie, I'm sure both V'gers will be looking just fine. Okay, while we're talking astronomy, why not keep our topic in that general area? Dark matter. It's out there. It's dark. It's matter. It's mysterious in a dark way. Maybe we can detect it by hearing it? Okay, so dark matter is a paradoxically hard-to-detect substance that probably makes up about 85% of the matter in the universe. Okay, here is the physics explanation of why this stuff is thought to exist. And I will admit, being a biologist, I do not entirely understand this explanation, but I will give it to you anyway. Dark matter was originally introduced to explain why the strong force, that's the one that holds protons and neutrons together, is the same backwards and forwards in time. This force would provide a natural explanation for the existence of dark matter that would form a, quote, pervasive wave flowing throughout space, unquote. This dark matter wave is called the axion. Due to advances in astrophysics, there has been a rush in the last couple of years to come up with new ideas for how to look for the axion in all areas where it could be hiding. The work on the newest study to look for the axion was published in October in the journal Physical Review Letters and was directed by Dr. Alexander Miller of Stockholm University. Miller says, quote, "Finding the axion is a bit like tuning a radio. You have to tune your antenna until you pick up the right frequency. Rather than music, experimentalists would be rewarded with hearing the dark matter that the Earth is traveling through. Despite being well motivated, axions have been experimentally neglected during the three decades since they were first proposed," unquote. The key insight of Miller's new study is that inside a magnetic field, axions would generate a small electric field that could be used to drive oscillations in plasma. A plasma is material where charged particles, like electrons, can flow freely as a fluid. We actually talked about plasma earlier. These oscillations amplify the signal, leading to a better axion-detecting radio. Unlike traditional experiments based on resonant cavities, where there is almost no limit on how large these plasmas can be, thus giving a larger signal, Miller explained that the difference is somewhat like the dissimilarity between a walkie-talkie and a radio broadcast tower. He posited that, quote, "The plasma plays a dual role, both creating an environment which allows for efficient conversion and providing a resonant plasmon to collect the energy of the converted dark matter. This is a totally new way to look for dark matter and will help us search for one of the strongest dark matter candidates in areas that are just completely unexplored. Building a tunable plasma would allow us to make much larger experiments than traditional techniques, giving much stronger signals at higher frequencies," unquote. Again, not sure I understand completely, but Miller explains that. He says that to tune this axion radio, the authors propose using something called a wire metamaterial, a system of wires thinner than hair that can be moved to change the characteristic frequency of the plasma. Inside a large powerful magnet similar to those used in magnetic resonance imaging machines in hospitals, a wire metamaterial turns into a very sensitive axion radio. I tell ya, I'm having flashbacks to reading E.E. Doc Smith. Didn't he propose semi-scientific stuff like this back in the 1920s when he wrote the Skylark and Lensman novels? Seriously, go read Smith's stuff and your head will hurt just as much as from that last paragraph that I just was talking about. Whether this is Doc Smithian tech or not, Miller and company are quite serious about it, and they are collaborating with an experimental group at Berkeley that is intent on building one of these detectors in the near future. Okay, last story of the night. Maybe the key to Alzheimer's treatment lies in seaweed? My sister put me on this next story, and I thank her for it. Obviously, my family is concerned with Alzheimer's matters, since it was a disease that affected my late father. As with any story that comes out of developing countries, even countries as developed as China, I take this with a major grain of salt. I don't really believe it, frankly, but I think that I'm not the only one. I've read some reviews in the last couple of days that suggest other researchers are not quite so agreeable to what they're proposing. At any rate, authorities in China have approved a drug for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, and this is the first new medicine with the potential to treat the cognitive disorder in about 17 years. Dr. Meiyu Geng of the Shanghai Institute of Materia Medica under the Chinese Academy of Sciences is responsible for the drug, and reports of its activity can be found in the journal Cell Research in September. Geng developed a seaweed-based drug called oligomannate that can be used for the treatment of mild to moderate Alzheimer's. As great as they think it may be, the Chinese government approval is conditional, meaning that while it can go on sale during additional clinical trials, it will be strictly monitored and it could be withdrawn for any safety issues at any time. Back in September, Geng reported in the paper that his group was inspired to look into seaweed due to the relative low incidence of Alzheimer's among people who consume seaweed regularly. Geng's team described how A sugar contained within seaweed suppresses certain bacteria in the gut, which can cause neural degeneration and inflammation of the brain, leading to Alzheimer's. This mechanism was confirmed during a clinical trial carried out by a company called Green Valley. It's a Shanghai-based pharmaceutical company that will be bringing the new drug to market. Conducted on 800 patients, the trial found that oligomannate, which is derived from brown algae, can statistically improve cognitive function among people with Alzheimer's in as little as 4 weeks, at least according to a statement from the company Green Valley. Geng says, quote, "These results advance our understandings of the mechanisms that play a role in Alzheimer's disease and imply that the gut microbiome is a valid target for the development of therapies. Our new drug is just as effective as the standard ones, but has fewer side effects," unquote. Since very little is known about the mechanisms of this new drug, Green Valley says it will also probe to see if it could have a protective effect and possibly slow down progression of the disease in patients who have yet to develop strong symptoms of dementia. The company said oligomannate will be available in China, quote-unquote, very soon, and it is currently seeking approval to market it abroad, with plans to launch third-phase clinical trials in the U.S. and Europe in early 2020. So Alzheimer's disease affects about 50 million people worldwide, including 9.5 million people in mainland China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. So if you think about it, Green Valley is very motivated to get this on the market. They can make a ton of money. What's strange is that a whole bunch of Western companies have been abandoning Alzheimer's drug trials because the disease has pretty much confounded researchers. And as lucrative as the business may be to get into, they just haven't been able to find anything promising. In fact, in October, the U.S. pharmaceutical company Biogen said it would cancel a large clinical trial for their drug aducanumab. And on top of that, Johnson & Johnson, Merck, Pfizer, and Eli Lilly have all previously abandoned projects to develop Alzheimer's drugs after unsatisfactory clinical trials. For those of us with a personal stake in the issue, it's not looking very good. I think part of the problem is the scientists and drug companies have such a bad handle on the causes of this awful degenerative disease that they don't even know where to start in treatment. I mean, where do you begin to design a treatment when the disease is such a black box? And some people have argued that oligomannate probably doesn't work as well as is believed to work for, among other reasons, that this inflammation from the bacteria in the gut leads to problems in the brain. And it's unclear as to exactly what's true and what's not. And I don't know. I just fear that throwing money at this problem will be a lot like our issues were with cancer 40 years ago. We eventually worked out the causes of cancer and have an excellent understanding now of what goes wrong in cells to induce cancer. Unfortunately, we still have no comprehensive effective treatments, even after all these years. In part because we discovered what a complicated disease it was and just how many myriad ways you can get it. I just hope that Alzheimer's doesn't follow in its tracks and that it's just a little simpler to work out. Well, that's all for me for now. Don't get that PhD unless you need and deserve it. Do your own writing. Be careful of Doc Smithian technology. Keep watching the skies for the return of V'ger. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.